Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to join us on Facebook at facebook.com/UNC Knowledge. You can submit questions, comments, suggest guests. Facebook. One of Britain's most distinguished journalists, Charles Moore, is a former editor of the Daily Telegraph and Sunday Telegraph newspapers and of the Spectator magazine. Mr. Moore is the authorized biographer of the Right Honorable the Baroness Thatcher of Kesteven, perhaps better known simply as Margaret Thatcher. Charles Moore, welcome.
Thank you.
Segment one, The Iron Lady. Until the Second World War, Britain represented the richest nation in Europe, the most powerful nation on earth, and the ruler of an empire that covered a quarter of the globe. By 1979, 3.5 decades later, Britain had lost its empire, become a power of the second rank, and had seen its living standards drop below those of Germany, Italy, France. Briefly, to set the scene, to set the stage, as it were, before the Iron Lady enters, what accounted for that decline? And what did it feel like? You were starting your career at this period in the 70s.
Well, Peter, in starting my career, I saw this very clearly because I came into Fleet Street journalism in October 1979, which was just after Mrs. Thatcher became Prime Minister. And so there was all the mess that she'd just taken over. What it meant was, for example, very high inflation and perhaps above all, a very, very severe control of labour by the labour unions. So industry functioned very badly. You couldn't bring about change. You couldn't sack people. You couldn't create new jobs. And the trade unions were highly political. So their leaderships were trying to run the country. And it was believed by many people that you could only run the country through a deal between the politicians and the leaders of the labor unions. And so you get the labor unions trying to sort of decide what economic policy would be. And there was any amount of closed shop, restrictive practices. So it did feel very much as if there was very little hope. And we had these enormously wasteful nationalized industries, coal, steel,
shipbuilding.
The cars were effectively, almost all the motor industry was effectively
nationalized. So striking about that, you mentioned coal, steel, and shipbuilding, and those were the industries that had been dominant a century before.
Yes.
But the socialist policies had in effect frozen British industry into a 19th century position in the second half of the 20th.
I think that's right. I think what happened was that for political reasons, it was felt that you had to, if an old heavy industry was doing badly, the thing to do was to, quote, save it, which in fact meant not allowing development change.
Taxing the productive segments of the economy.
Exactly so.
And the bail out the unproductive.
Exactly so. And the tax rates were correspondingly high, of course, so that if you... The tax rate on unearned income, so-called unearned income, when Mrs. Thatcher came in was right up in the 90s. Mm. Even on so-called earned income was up in the 80s. So it was enormously burdensome and restrictive.
Enter Margaret Thatcher.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I stand before you tonight in my red star chiffon evening gown. My face softly made up and my fair hair gently waved. The Iron Lady of the Western World.
The Iron Lady, that sobriquet comes from what?
Mrs. Thatcher made a very powerful speech in which she attacked the principles of détente and said that we were ignoring the dangers from the Soviet Union. And the Red Army newspaper, Red Star, came back at her, obviously controlled by the Communist Party.
Right.
And it said, she's the Iron Lady. And this was the best compliment ever paid you by a critic, by an enemy, because they meant it to say, how hard and unfeeling and dreadful she was. But of course, that's exactly what she wanted to be seen as in relation to the Soviet communism.
Now, Charles, I want to get to the policies, to the events of the Thatcher years. But first, where did this come from? That self-possession, the toughness. There she was. This is, as I recall, this speech was delivered a year or so, some months before she became prime minister. Years before she became prime minister. And here she is taking on the Soviets and equating with the Soviets the Labor government. This is a breathtaking act of defiance. And this woman was raised over a grocery shop in Grantham, a medium-sized, nondescript town in middle, nondescript England.
You're right. But I think by the way you've described it, you've fastened onto why she felt able to speak in this way. It was precisely because she came from this, what you might call, wrong side of the tracks background, and because she was a woman in a man's world, that she had a very independent approach. She never thought, I must go with the crowd. Right back in Grantham, her father, a grocer, a local politician, and a Methodist lay preacher, he would say things like to her like, dare to be a Daniel. Stand up for what you believe. Don't worry about what the crowd says. And she would have taken that to heart very much. And then as she made her way through life, she's essentially acting alone. There's no big group of pals helping her.
She's not a part of the old boys network.
Absolutely not. Neither by sex nor by character. And of course, very ambitious. But she had very strong beliefs. And I think what most struck her as she grew up and matured in politics was the horror of her country going downhill and of the sense of failure. And what Margaret Thatcher cares about so much is the idea that her country has enormous potential and that needs to be brought out. And for the Conservative Party, above all, the Conservative Party of which she was a member, to fail in that, which she felt it had done in the mid-70s, was a terrible rebuke.
A segment two, the Falklands. April 1982, you're a young journalist, so you will remember all of this vividly. Argentina invades and occupies the Falklands. I happened to be in Britain myself at the time, and it was a complete shock. The first question was, why would they care? Why would anybody want these Falklands? That's what I remember people saying to each other. Describe to us Prime Minister Thatcher's response.
Well, the invasion of the Falklands was, among other things, completely unexpected, except by a very few people. Mm-hmm. And so the British government didn't actually know that it was going to be invaded by Argentina until a day before the event took place. And therefore, obviously, there were virtually no preparations. And here we are, we have...
By the way, I should say, the Falkland Islands are in the South Atlantic, about 250 miles from the coast of Argentina, and about 6,000 miles.
Yes, more, I think,
More than 6,000 or more miles from the United Kingdom.
Yeah. Right, go ahead. The Falkland Islands are a British colony, were and are a British colony, but a colony unlike many where everybody in it wanted to be. They were all of British descent and they wished to continue to be with Britain. And so the question is an act of military aggression, what do you do about it? And basically, Mrs. Thatcher understood that if you didn't respond, the government would fall because the indignation was total by British public opinion. And the Marines that we had a very small garrison out there, they were captured. So complete humiliation. And so the question is, what do you do? And Mrs. Thatcher didn't know what to do in the sense that there were no preparations for this. The logistics are terrible. The politics are unprecedented.
If I recall, you may correct me on this, but as I recall, there's an especially vivid scene in her autobiography in which she's being briefed on all of this. And John Knott, who's the Minister for Defense, who has earlier that day rounded up the admirals and said, what's going to be happen? What can we do? And presented to Mrs. Thatcher the view of the defense ministry that essentially the Falklands were lost. And there was one man, but fill in this, tell the rest of this
story. This is essentially correct. By chance, almost all the main people who are supposed to help with these decisions were out of the country that day. And that turned out to be a good thing because Mrs. Thatcher was sitting in the House of Commons having a sort of long-running meeting, trying to work out what they could do, drafting a letter to President Reagan asking for advice and assistance and so on. One admiral, the first Sea Lord, was in town And he'd just been inspecting naval positions, so he was wearing his uniform. And he heard this meeting was going on. He wasn't asked to it. And he came bursting into it in the House of Commons. He
had to sort of, Leach, was it not?
Leach, who's yes. called Henry Leach. And he sort of found his way through. And Mrs. Thatcher was very, very pleased to see him because she always respects the armed services. And she didn't know, you know, what to think about all of this from a military point of view. And so everyone was very gloomy, including John Nott, the Defence Secretary, who you mentioned. And she said, well, First Sea Lord, what could we do? And he said, well, Prime Minister, we could send a task force. And she said, because she had very little military experience at this point early, she said, what's a task force? So he said, explained. And she said, how long would it take to get ready? And he said, 3 days. And she said, how long would it take to get to the Falklands? And he said, 3 weeks. And she said, you mean 3 days, don't you? And he said, no, 3 weeks, 3 weeks. She had no idea of the geographical.
Right.
And she said, can we do it? Can we reconquer the islands? And he said, yes, Prime Minister, we can. And though it's not for me to say, I think we must. And so she got interested. And she said, why? Why do you say that? And he said, because if we don't do it, we will be a country whose word counts for nothing in the world. And of course, then she was really on her mettle. And suddenly she'd been given the sense that it was possible, because no matter what her ambitions, if she's advised by everybody that it's not physically possible, she has to give up. But, it's possible. So she said, right, well, let's make ready the task force. And the cabinet agreed to that on the Friday night, big debate on the House of Commons on the Saturday night, which she survived, though with some difficulty. And the task force set sail on Monday. And once it's in the sea, on the way, or on the sea, I should say, very hard to turn it back. And what Mrs. Thatcher then had to manage was an incredibly difficult diplomatic situation when you're trying to see if you could get a non-military solution without conceding the crucial points, and which she had to hold off people who wanted to appease Argentina.
And everyone, as I recall, everyone, The Economist, the Financial Times, the whole diplomatic corps, I mentioned that these small islands were much closer to Argentina than to thousands of miles from Britain, only a few hundred miles from Argentina. The population was a few thousand.
Yes,
many, many thousands more than that of sheep.
Yep.
But the population was only a few thousand. So the notion that you cut a deal was overwhelming.
It was overwhelming in the minds of diplomats, but in the opposite feeling in the minds of the British people. Mm. Because
so she had the people with her more or less from the get-go.
Yes. But of course, it could have died because of sheer military failure, apart from anything else. So the loneliness of her position in this and the difficulty of trying to work out what to do and the, you know...
And Leach was not representative, really. It was almost by a kind of a sweet miracle that the one man who had mettle happened to find his way into the meeting at that moment.
That's right. I mean, to be fair to the others, they did have mettle, but they were just very, very aware of the difficulty. It was a very, very serious logistical, strategic difficulty. And, you know, how would you land on the islands? Terrible weather, no cover, so you get attacked by a very effective Argentine Air Force and so on. However, Mrs. Thatcher saw that you had to do this unless you could get a peace with honour. And Argentina was so stupid that it didn't offer that.
Mm.
And she had a lot of to-ing and fro with the United States, often very tense.
Yes.
It wasn't always very easy with Secretary Haig. President Reagan slightly hedging his bets because there was a genuine, very understandable U.S. fear of resurgent communism in South America. But in the end, the strength of our alliance with the United States and her personal friendship with President Reagan meant that they came down on the British side. So we had all the logistical and sort of diplomatic backup we needed. And then it was a wonderful military achievement. And the British forces distinguished themselves and they won. And with a relatively small loss of life and virtually no, I think two or three civilians died in the whole
there
conflict.
I believe there were two or three civilians on the Belgrano. Belgrano, the Argentines lose the Belgrano, the British lose the Sheffield. In other words, two ships went down, 907 killed, 74 days of conflict, but Britain wins.
And it's Great Britain. Marvelous forces, every single one of them. It's just been everyone together.
And that's what matters. We knew what we had to do. We knew what we had to do. And we went about it.
To me, what's so striking about that is that you can hear the crowd singing Rule Britannia in the background just off Downing Street.
Yeah. Which, of course, now they wouldn't be allowed to do because of security, apart from anything
else.
So the crowd are all...
Segment three, the strike. 1984, the National Coal Board, which is the government body that oversees Britain's nationalized and heavily subsidized coal industry, announces that the game is about to change. Instead of subsidies without end and accommodation with the unions without end, it intends to close 20 unproductive, unprofitable mines. 20,000 jobs will be eliminated. In certain towns in the north, virtually the only source of employment is about to come to an end. The National Union of Mine Workers is led by a man called Arthur Scargill. Tell us about Arthur Scargill and what he chooses to do.
Well, in a way, Arthur Scargill was the best gift to Mrs. Thatcher because there'd been a long history of confrontation with the National Union of Mine Workers. But before that, they'd been led by fairly moderate people who were very difficult to argue with politically because they had a sort of moral stature. Arthur Scargill was a hardline communist, not actually a member of the Communist Party, but an ultra-extremist. And
also, he called himself a Marxist, I recall. There was
That's right.
Right. And, you're not casting aspersions.
No. and he had a declaredly political agenda. He wanted to defeat and overthrow the Thatcher government. And he also actually had money, which was later exposed, from Soviet Russia and from Libya. So you were up against something that really was subversive of the political order. But the Tories had had a history of losing in all of this. And indeed, Mrs. Thatcher herself had given in to the miners in 1981 with a similar comparable dispute because she wasn't ready. Mm. And by this time, she was ready. She got the coal stocks prepared to last out a strike. And she changed the law about picketing so that the union could now be held liable in the courts for secondary picketing. And that made it much easier to distrain the union funds.
Let's take a look at her response to Arthur Scargill and the strike.
You talk about the ruthless, manipulating few. Now, will you not negotiate with them ever?
I will never negotiate with people who use coercion and violence to achieve their objective. They are the enemies of democracy. They are not interested in the future of democracy. They are trying to kill democracy for their own purposes.
Pretty tough. The strike lasts about a year, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it just fizzles. The miners go back to work.
Yes. Another great advantage Mrs. Thatcher had in this was that Arthur Scargill never had a ballot for the strike because he knew that if he did, he wouldn't win it.
That's why she gets to talk about a small minority of manipulating the larger...
Exactly. Right. She always knew that that he didn't have all the miners with him. And right through the strike, a third of them went on working. And as in the later part of the strike, that grew to half and so on. But he called on union solidarity to make the strike happen. And, of course, it was very dangerous, very hard going. And there was a point about halfway through where it really did look as if she would lose it. But she pulled through in this knowledge that he didn't really have the legitimacy. And so though a lot of people hated it because it was all very tough and unpleasant and bitter, she did essentially have the moral argument on her side as well as the economic and political argument. And that was sort of tacitly acknowledged even by people who didn't like her. And once she'd won, everything changes. This had lifted the incubus which had been on British governments about trade union power.
Falklands War in 82 gives her stature, and in 84 she uses it. She changes Britain. Is that fair?
That's fair. And in between, she'd won a huge majority in the general election of 1983, and so she felt she had a real mandate.
Mm. Charles, once again, this question the question of courage, an old-fashioned virtue of courage. Falklands first. 1956, Prime Minister Anthony Eden bungles the brief Suez operation against Egypt in the Suez Canal, and it ends up costing him the premiership. Mm. She knows, as she goes to war in the Falklands, that if that fails, she's gone.
Yes.
There's a clear precedent in British history.
Yes.
Her government, her job, her entire everything is at stake.
Yeah.
She does it anyway.
Yeah.
And then we come to 1984 and this National Union of Mine Workers strike. just a decade earlier, they'd gone out on strike with Edward Heath. Edward Heath had been a prime minister, her predecessor's Tory prime minister. He had been putting in place some free market reforms. He'd been tough by the standards of the day. They bring the country to its knees and force him to reverse himself. Mm-hmm. And it costs Heath the government and the premiership. Yeah. She, within 24 months, she risks everything. Yeah. Twice. Where did this come from, this mettle, this courage?
Well, it's innate in her character, but it's also to do with the fact that she's all alone. So she knows that no excuses are going to be made for her if anything goes wrong. There are no pals to cover up for her, hold her in office after any disaster. She would always say this, that, you know, a woman's only got one chance. Mm. And So in a way, she'd done what you're not supposed to do in politics, which is, if you're in a hole, stop digging. It was in the hole and went on digging, in the sense that she knew only by playing the game as hard as you could you win.
Segment four, the Cold War. Even under Mrs. Thatcher, Britain remains a power of the second rank. It's not a superpower, not a nation that can in any way conceivably set forward its military as a counterweight to the Soviet Union or its economy as a counterweight to the United States. And yet Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev and every right-minded historian of whom I'm aware recognizes that she played a central role in the end of the Cold War. Mm.
Yes.
Why is that recognition accorded to her? What?
I think because she knew when to hold them and when to fold them. And also to do with the alliance with Reagan, because essentially she and Reagan had analyzed the situation correctly in the 70s when they were not yet in office, mm-hmm. which was that Soviet power was becoming more and more threatening, and it had both political and military consequences, and the thing was in the balance. And she led the fight in Western Europe to install cruise and Pershing missiles to counter the Soviet nuclear missiles in the early 80s.
1983, the United States deploys missiles in Britain and West Germany, and I think there were a small deployment in Italy as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And she takes an anti-nuclear demonstration in Hyde Park, as I recall, was to that point the largest public demonstration in British history.
Certainly very big. But it had turned out in the 1983 election that the Labour belief in unilateral nuclear disarmament had helped them to lose very big. And she realised, simple point but important, that if you use the word unilateral, not many people know what it means. But if you say one-sided, they do know what it means. And she would say, Labour wants one-sided disarmament. And this proved to be very, very effective for her. So once she'd carried this with the European allies, with her own electorate, she's in a very strong position to think, well, what happens next? We've pushed the Soviets back on this. Mm. What happens next?
Can we? I'd just like to play a clip from her eulogy that she recorded it about 18 months before President Reagan died, but it was played at his funeral. Mm. There are a couple of points about this that I'd like to ask you about, Charles.
Yes, he did not shrink from denouncing Moscow's evil empire, but he realized that a man of goodwill might nonetheless emerge from within its dark corridors. So the president resisted Soviet expansion and pressed down on Soviet weakness at every point until the day came when communism began to collapse beneath the combined weight of those pressures and its own failures. And when a man of goodwill did emerge from the ruins, President Reagan stepped forward to shake his hand and to offer sincere cooperation.
She met Gorbachev, still a junior member of the Politburo, about 3 months before the unexpected death of Chernenko, mm-hmm. and Gorbachev's elevation to general secretary.
Yeah.
As I recall, they met at Chequers, the prime minister's country residence. They were scheduled to meet for about an hour. Mm. It ran 5 hours, and she made a point of saying publicly soon thereafter, I like Mr. Gorbachev. We can do business together.
Yeah.
And here in this eulogy, she calls him a man of goodwill.
Yeah.
Now, what's so striking about the event as it takes place in 1985, I like Mr. Gorbachev, and this eulogy, a man of goodwill. Here we have Margaret Thatcher, the unreconstructed, unrepentant, anti-communist, cold warrior par excellence, and she sees Gorbachev and changes her thinking, or at least recognizes something. In other words, you get a remarkable intellectual agility, no?
I think that's correct. She never thought that Soviet communism had anything good about it, but she detected in Gorbachev a readiness to recognize reality. And she thought that conversation you mentioned at Chequers was vital, because if you read, you can't yet do so, but people will eventually be able to read the conversation, and the tremendous argument they have with one another, where they're very, very frank and each attacks the other's system and so on. But this actually builds up a basis of trust. Nobody's conceding points of principle, but they enjoy the talk and it's very frank and clear. And they then see that there are actually things that they can think about together. And so some sort of human rapport is established, and some idea that, well, you know, we don't have to be threatening one another all the time. And from that, Mrs. Thatcher thought, right, we can move. She had the confidence that the Western system would ultimately prevail, both economically and militarily and politically. And that confidence pushed her forward to think, well, you can also negotiate. And so off she went to President Reagan that very week, flew via Peking and Hong Kong and Pearl Harbor. She dropped in on the way, in the middle of the night, by the way, to Washington, saw President Reagan to talk about this, to tell him, because the Reagan administration needed some persuading on this matter, and a lot of people who admired Mrs. Thatcher in the administration did not agree with her about this, that this was worth pursuing.
Reagan did.
Yes. Yeah, and of course that was the key thing that Reagan did. And what she was trying to do all the time was to keep the alliance together, prevent Gorbachev from driving a wedge between Western allies, but help move President Reagan on. And so when in that tribute she was talking about Gorbachev as a man of goodwill, that's a good phrase, because she wasn't saying he was right about anything, but she was saying that he had the necessary will. You could have the conversation with him.
Right. Charles, let me ask about one... this is frustrating, because even if it's a web and we can talk, I'd love to have a 5-hour conversation with you. I like Mr. Moore. We can do business together. But let me ask about one aspect of her relationship with Ronald Reagan. Mm. And this is to me, it's so fascinating, because it's a disagreement. Mm. And there's policy, and it was questions of analysis, but also the friendship, all bound up in this. Reagan, Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars. Now, she doesn't like it. And in fact, I can't remember the year, 84 perhaps, she flies to Camp David. It hammers out this agreement, 4 points, which was...
Yes, this was the same occasion as she saw him about Gorbachev.
Yes, yeah. Yes. One of the 4 points was that the Strategic Defense Initiative would be used to enhance deterrence rather than undermine it.
Yeah.
And as best I read the situation, President Reagan just said, well, whatever her form of words will please her, let her have it. Mm. But she wanted to tie the Strategic Defense Initiative into the status quo, which wasn't the game he was playing at all. No. He wanted to overturn the status quo. Mm. Reykjavik, 1986, Reagan almost agrees to Gorbachev's sweeping proposals to reduce nuclear weapons, and walks out in the end because Gorbachev says you must limit SDI to research only, no deployment. Mrs. Thatcher, in her autobiography on Reykjavik, it was like an earthquake. There was no place where you could put your political feet. Mm. And yet, later, she writes that the decision to pursue the Strategic Defense Initiative was the most far-reaching and consequential of Reagan's administration. Hmm. Put all that together for me, will you?
Well, I think it can be done. I mean, she was very shocked, not by SDI, but by Reagan's belief that you could just do away with nuclear weapons. She did not agree with him about that. She thought that nuclear weapons were the best guarantee of peace in a wicked world because of the deterrent effect. And whenever he said, let's get rid of the whole lot, this really frightened her. She was worried about SDI for similar reasons, because she thought this was a utopian idea about how you could supersede all existing. Right. But she also could see its great political utility and its capacity to make the Russians feel they couldn't keep up. So when she was doing all this stuff about you can have the research but not the deployment, what she was trying to do was to get a line which all the allies could agree on so that there wouldn't be a terrible bust-up between the other allies and the United States. She was very happy that Reagan pushed SDI forward not as an actual reality of exactly what you're going to do, but as a sort of concept that would terrify the Russians.
Charles, segment five, last segment of last, what she leaves us. 1990, Margaret Thatcher's final appearance in the House of Commons as Prime Minister after 11 years. They made her the longest serving Prime Minister since Lord Liverpool. And that's a test of how long ago it was because nobody remembers Lord Liverpool. So question is she worn out? Is she weary? Is she fatigued? Take a look.
I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I'm extremely grateful. The Prime Minister is aware that I detest every single one of her domestic policies and have never had that.
And I think that the Honourable Gentleman knows that I have the same contempt for his socialist policies as the people of East Europe who have experienced it have it for that. I must have hit the right nail on the head when I pointed out that the logic of those policies are they'd rather have the poor poorer. Once they start to talk about the gap, they'd rather the gap were that. Down here. That. Not that.
She's superb.
But that. So long as the gap is smaller, so long as the gap
Order.
Is smaller, they'd rather have the poor poorer. You do not create wealth and opportunity that way. You do not create a property-owning democracy that way.
She'd won the Falklands War. She played a central role in the West's victory in the Cold War. She led the Conservative Party to three victories in general elections. Behind Germany, Italy, and France in living standards when she took office, Britain is essentially pulled even by the time she leaves office, and she's set policies in place that permit Britain to overtake all three in the following decade. Her own colleagues in the Conservative Party turfed her out. Why?
Well, my own interpretation of it is that it was a top-down revolt rather than a bottom-up revolt. And I think it was really because her colleagues were fed up with her being in charge of them for so long, and she was not always polite to them. And also a lot of them...
She did not mellow.
No, she didn't mellow, no. And in fact, she probably got more arrogant with the passing of the years. And she also had a profound difference of opinion with them about the European Union, because she believed that the European Union was going to take away British sovereignty become a United States of Europe of a very dangerous kind. And many of them disagreed. And so they capitalized on her wider unpopularity, which was more to do with a particular tax that she'd introduced and the fact she'd been in for so long, and they led a sort of coup against her. Even in that coup against her, which was a leadership ballot of her own members of parliament, she won. She got more votes than her opponent, but not enough to prevent a second ballot, and therefore she was advised that this was unwise to push it any longer. There wasn't enough backing, and she went, and she was probably right to do that. But it was an extraordinary thing, because I saw her shortly afterwards and I said, she was going to write her memoirs, which of course she did, and I said, what are you going to call them? And she said, undefeated. And the reason for that was, of course, that it was absolutely true that she was undefeated. She'd won, as you say, all those elections, and she'd actually won the leadership ballot which caused her to leave. But it also expressed her character, because she felt she prevailed in the matters in which she wished to prevail.
Charles, her legacy. Mrs. Thatcher wants a United Kingdom ruled from the Palace of Westminster. She defeats the unions. In 1984, she completes 1,000 years of British political development. The House of Commons rules Britain. And now we have an assembly in Scotland, an assembly in Wales that have taken sovereignty away from the House of Commons, and still more to the point, a constant leeching of sovereignty to Brussels. She wanted a Britain that was proud of its own identity. Today, we're well into multiculturalism. And with the 20 years of immigration and high birth rates among the Muslim population, there are neighborhoods, particularly in the north, where Sharia law is an alternative to British law. She wants free markets. She wants constant pressure on the welfare state. Today, the Conservative Prime Minister, David Cameron, talks incessantly about social services. He sounds more like Edward Heath than like Margaret Thatcher. She wanted a Britain that was strong as was reasonable based on the size of its economy. And this past spring, Prime Minister David Cameron, a conservative, her successor as conservative prime minister, even as he was calling on NATO to commence operations in Libya, he was shrinking British defense spending and decommissioning the last British aircraft carrier, the Ark Royal, which, by the way, in this morning's news, they put it up for auction and a Hong Kong firm wants to buy the Ark Royal and turn it into a floating shopping mall. What did she leave that lasts?
Well, I would say that she left, first of all, a huge change in economic ideas, so that nobody wants to go back to all the state subsidy, union power, nationalize industries. And this became a global concept that she exported, of which privatization is the best known. So that is common ground, even with the moderate left these days. I mean, they don't really like it, but nobody wants to go back. Secondly, I think she left an idea which, in my opinion, will go on, as much as one can say, ever say in politics, forever, all over the world, which is a certain robust idea of freedom, a sort of active idea of freedom. A sense that if you work hard enough at this, you can prevail. It's true that the immediate legacy, sort of 20 years on, is very contested. And Mrs. Thatcher is a very, very controversial figure, and she never took any prisoners. So there were people who were horrified by what she did and wished to overturn it. And so there's, she's someone who stirs up tremendous emotions. There was an element of damage in that, but it was a price worth paying, I think, for her belief that you must tell the truth. And that the trouble with democratic politics is that illusions tend to prevail because illusions are easier. Now I notice that as we're in an era of deficits and massive debt problems and massive government spending problems, I notice, because I've been working on this for some time, that her reputation is growing very much in the United Kingdom, having been gone quite low at one point, because people see how much she tried to deal with real problems. And what they tend to notice is that current politicians are not dealing so much with real problems. And I detect a similar debate going on in the United States. I think there's a feeling, and you often get people say, not people who necessarily agree with her, but they say, we need a Maggie Thatcher.
So her example itself is a substantive achievement.
Yes, I think it's very much
it everything. Gives the rising generation something to hold on to.
Everything to do with Margaret Thatcher is not precisely ideological. It's very much to do with character as well. It's to do with how can somebody here, and here is this example of this woman all alone, tackle the problems that need tackling. Margaret Thatcher is a titanic figure in the history of Britain, and I think she has already entered myth. And so, as you know, the symbols of monarchy in Britain are the orb and the scepter. But the symbol of power with Margaret Thatcher is the handbag. And this thing could come to mean so much. And this thing wielded by her, the symbol of power, tells you a huge amount about the change of the role of women in society, the importance of character, and the importance of a particularly British approach to political rule, which I think will continue to mean a lot for centuries.
Final question. Margaret Thatcher summed up Ronald Reagan's place in history in one sentence. Ronald Reagan won the Cold War without firing a shot. You've produced a book on Margaret Thatcher. Could I ask you to try for one sentence? What should we hold on to about her?
She had the courage of her convictions, and her convictions were proved right by the course of history.
Charles Moore, journalist and biographer of Margaret Thatcher, thank you.
Thank you.
For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson, and before I say goodbye, I'd like you to know that for access to thousands of historical documents relating to Mrs. Thatcher and her time in government, you can visit the Thatcher Foundation at easiest web address in the world to remember, Margaret Thatcher, one word, margaretthatcher.org. And now, Peter Robinson for Uncommon Knowledge saying thank you.